Man, we laid down some sweet, sweet podcast.
Yeah.
Mage!
Hi, Mage fans. This is Terry Robinson with Mage of the Podcast. And today, my special guest in his capacity as the co-director of the Open Halls Project is Josh Heath. Josh, how you doing?
I am doing really well, Terry. Hello, everybody out there in Mage Land. I hope you are streaming your way to ascension with all of our assistance. Yeah. So I'm excited to have this conversation today.
We are having this conversation on New Year's Eve, which shows how cool we are. How are you ringing in the new year?
I'm actually going and potentially playing Trinity Aeon with my friends while we wait for the new year to occur. So
I hope all of your gaming is full of delight. I think the only game I'll be playing is possibly Ghost Court, which is a party game where you're a ghost suing a person or a person suing a ghost, and there'll be a lot of champagne. So what could possibly go wrong?
Nothing could go wrong. So Marshall Bradshaw ran that at a convention in D.C. that for WashingCon. It was amazing. There was a whole audience of people, like 30 people playing Ghost Court.
Oh, interesting.
It was amazing.
Huh. Well, in slightly more germane to Mage and slightly more academically informed news, our topic today is the magical practices of the Northern Germanic peoples of Europe. Is that a safe way to talk about the intersection of Vikings and heathenisms and the Norse?
Yeah, I think that is an overly complicated way of putting it, which makes it great. It makes me happy. When it is overly complicated, because it's not as simple as any like single word or group of words will make it. But I would be comfortable saying Norse magic would be completely appropriate.
Okay.
Or if you're stretching, Norse magical medical practice, because those two things interweave with one another as well.
So what is your background with these topics, if you're comfortable sharing?
Yeah. So I've been a heathen since I was 11, which is a long time ago now. And I have been the co-director of a heathen military organization for the last 9 years. I've been involved in a long-standing kindred and a long community of heathens for 20-some-odd years, 25-ish years now. So for me, this was my first love academically. I have the equivalent of a PhD probably in research in this topic. My spouse is also a heathen and is writing a book on heathen magic. So she is actually the expert that I have learned most of these things via osmosis from. And and I am a little bit more familiar with Mage. So here to help, you know, translate and talk about some of those things.
Yes, to answer the question of why are we not just talking to Josh's spouse. So what is a heathen? And this is heathen with a capital H, right?
Yes. So heathen refers to the modern, specifically the modern practitioners of a faith with echoes and similarities to the faiths that people in Northern Europe practiced prior to Christianization. So the reason I add a lot of padding to that is we are reconstructionist faith. We recognize that we have to restore our understanding of the worldview that developed or produced specific practices, but we are not LARPing. We are not recreating. We are not doing everything exactly as was done in, say, 800 in Sweden or Norway or even in Iceland. Instead, we are looking at those places as inspiration and understanding how they viewed the world and why they viewed the world, and then turning that to our modern day and saying, how do we implement this worldview day to day?
Now, is that a case where there could be a historical or archaeological discovery that would actively change your faith? Like, oh, we found documentation of this belief that was popular in the 700s or something like that. Would that update the faith in the same way that theoretically maybe a new Judeo-Christian document could be unearthed, which would shed light on contemporary scholarship? How much of a tie is there directly then to that past?
Yeah, we view scholarship and academia on a much higher level than personal gnosis, and this is not true of all heathens, but personal gnosis and research play very conflictual roles in our community, insofar as if archaeology or any sort of research comes out, if we were to discover Heimdallskona, which is a lost poem, and it was incredibly important lost poem that was not part of any of the saved manuscripts that we have today. For me, that would be particularly amazing, and for everyone else, for most heathens, it would change how we understand the world, but it may not drastically change everyone's practice because we're a decentralized faith. So it's hard to say exactly what effect, but for most people, it would be like, hey, this is cool new stuff. How do we implement it? What do we learn from it? And we would adjust accordingly.
So that explains what the heathenisms are. What is some other associated terms? What does it mean for something to be Norse?
That's a good question because it's hard to define it in some ways. But Norse generally refers to the Scandinavian countries. So Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Iceland, some parts of Russia, some parts of northern England, and some parts of Ireland and a bunch of the islands in between Norway and Ireland and Scotland. The reason I kind of like say somewhat and bits and pieces here and there is because the Norse people moved, particularly during the Viking era. They traveled a lot of different places. They settled in a lot of different places, and their influence is felt in a lot of different places in the world. So it does not include some of the indigenous peoples in Norway and Sweden, the Sama. They are their own cultural group, a Finno-Ugric cultural group, but otherwise anyone within Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and Iceland, you could generally say they are the Norse, and you'd be right.
To slightly misquote a colleague of mine who once asked, who or what is a Michael Bublé? Who or what is a Viking?
So a Viking is a Norse person, usually a Norse man, but not always, a Norse person that would go and become a pirate for a season. Usually these were farmers, or occasionally they were people of wealth that would decide, hey, I need more money, and we are in a mini ice age. And you know who has lots of money and resources and things I need? Those English or those Spanish or those French or whomever they were going to go pirate.
Okay. So that was a case where it started out as a verb. One went a Viking and then it became kind of a job. I am a Viking. And then we kind of turned that into an idea of a culture, the Vikings.
Correct. Which is a misinterpretation of Norse culture to call it the Viking culture, but a lot of people do because they see Vikings as a representation of those people. But no, these were generally outlaws and people that were pushed to their wits' end to go and become pirates because they're like, I have nothing. The farm is not working this season and we need some way of surviving.
Kind of like if we were to refer to the American West over the past two centuries as the bandit culture or something like that.
Shockingly accurate.
Yay! I have my moments. Mage is interesting as a game because it is both the case that we are looking at actual human practices, but also we are looking for materials we can use to literally play a game where we sit around a table and talk about throwing spells at one another. Is there or was there a notion of what maybe a lay reader would see as a magical practice within the Norse areas, and what did that look like?
The easy answer is yes. The hard answer is going to take us the next 20 minutes, I take.
Okay.
Like one way or the other. So yes, there are lots of different magical practices within a Norse framework. And when we talk about them as Norse magic, I think that's a better like general term for lots of different things. For example, I'm going to start at fiber magic. Fiber magic is incredibly important. The idea of building intent into fiber creations, both from spinning to weaving to knob bending, which is a type of knitting or crochet, a little bit closer to crochet than anything else. The production of clothing as a magical practice was incredibly important in Norse culture. Some people view the runes, which were a writing system used by the Norse people, as a type of magical tool. And yes, they were, insofar as any writing system is the way of recording ideas and thoughts and feelings, and so therefore can be magical. However, we also have runes that literally said, I farted here, or I was here, is actually written in the Hagia Sophia in runes. And there are lots, there's actually a list that one woman made to her husband saying, please bring back a cow and some wheat and some other things from market. So we have this view of runes as these magical system, but almost all of that, all of what we understand as magic in runes, is completely modern and is not historic. There are historical magical uses of runes. Those are two big ones. There's also Saith, which is a term that refers to a few different practices, but specifically about utilizing spirits, interacting with spirits and things like that. Spey is another term that is used to refer to some specific magical practices. There's going under the cloak, which is a type of meditation that was performed specifically to commune with the elves. There's also lots of other things.
One of the things that the West generally gets wrong when we're interpreting other cultures, or I'll say the modern American West or what have you, is we often confuse the practice for the output. So in our episode, we were talking about the tarot, Eastern European tarot readers. It is the reader that is magical and the cards are merely a conduit for it. When a magical practitioner is weaving something, is it the woven object that is magical, or it is the act, or is it the act of weaving that is the magic, if that makes sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In a mage context, you are casting the spell, you are rolling your arete when you are creating the object, when you are spinning, or when you are adding your intent into whatever it is that you are doing. And then that becomes a wonder or a talisman.
Now, what is the paradigm that is kind of underlying it? Like, what is kind of the view of the cosmos, if there is one, that acts as an organizing principle? Now, in a lot of cases, there isn't necessarily one, but is it a case where you are, does magic come from the person? Is it a request upon a deity or the forces of the universe? Is there a notion of fate? What's kind of the worldview that this magic is coming out of?
Heathen culture, archheathen culture, and modern heathen culture to some degree is based on the idea of reciprocity.
Okay.
Everything has a relationship with something else, with everything else. We are all connected. There are some potential similarities in that idea with emptiness in Buddhism, insofar that we are connected to absolutely everything. We have a responsibility to negotiate all of the interactions that we have. So magic is, from a Norse context, about adjusting, fixing, moving, and changing how those relationships are in one form or another. So when you are weaving something, for example, you are building a new product out of all of the different threads, literally, that become this final object. With runes, you are invoking both the meta-magical elements that the runes represent, as well as the written concepts that you are trying to cement into whatever it is that you are creating, and then that final thing is a spell, an idea, a thing of itself. So the other element is everything is spiritually aware or awake in some form. It is semi-animistic in that way, in that everything has a spiritual energy. And there are some people that are going to yell at me for using terms like that, but it's not untrue in this case, in that everything is alive. So bringing those things into accordance with another to have a specific effect is at the basis of heathen magical systems.
What was the notion of fate or destiny? Was there an order to the cosmos? And kind of, did the magician or the magical practitioner have a role that was special in that?
Yes, there's a lot of misinterpretation about fate.
Okay.
In a Norse context. So a lot of researchers misunderstand the idea of fate in, particularly in the Norse myths, in that, okay, the gods know that there's a prophecy that they're going to die and the world is going to be reborn. But Odin does everything he can to get ahead of that prophecy and take action against it and build barriers to make it not as bad as it could be. Because what this represented more accurately is a sense of Orlog. And Orlog is the accumulated, more like the universe's accumulated set of actions. So everything that has happened before, including everything from the Big Bang onwards, means that we have a restriction of things that we are physically capable of doing, physically, metaphysically able to do. The actions that we have taken within our lives are our weird. And those are the accumulated set of actions. For example, if I'm a runner, and I have been running since I was a teenager, and I'm not. If I were, then I would be a good runner today because I have built up all of that skill to be able to do so. Same with writing. You work up a lot of skill to become a writer. You become a good writer. You get a publication contract. You get money, in theory. One of us will someday get money. That is your weird. That is like the accumulated set of things that you have done. So in some ways, those things are similar to fate, but you can change what you do. Okay. I can go and join the army. One of the major things that I did at one point in my life is I was living in my car. Things were not going well for me. And I changed my fate by joining the army, going the other side of the world, meeting my spouse. We went to Germany together. We built up a good nest egg of money. We moved. We had a child. I have 2 degrees. And now these wonderful podcasts with Terry and Werewolf the Podcast. Like, I changed everything, my whole direction of my life, by specifically going out and saying, I'm changing what I do now. And you can do that from a magical context, in a Norse magical context.
Would I be able to say that one's weird is how one's past and actions inform one's present?
Yes, that is more accurate than most people would say it. So yes.
100%. Okay. And the idea then of quote-unquote fate is just that, not that we are bound by the past, but we've done things that informs our now, and our now defines what our immediate future can look like. So if you want to shift that future by a certain amount, you got some hoofing to do.
Yeah, and you are bound by the actions you have taken and the actions that everybody else has taken before you.
Hmm.
Your family has done things, good and bad, that make you who you are, whether or not you know who they are or not. And that is both, that is weird, is both your actions and all the accumulated direct actions of people around you. And yeah, you're right. You can take action to shift and change things. And in a mage standpoint, mages have the ability to shift and change things more,
mm-hmm.
but there's still limitations that you are going to be under just because you are who you are.
So a Norse magical practitioner would not quote-unquote manipulate weird then. Like the idea of that would be, is almost nonsensical.
Yeah. So in most of the mage books, weird is referenced as a force that you can move and shift and change because they're viewing it kind of like karma.
Yep.
And again, I think that's a misinterpretation of karma to see it that way, because karma is similar to weird in that mm-hmm. it is the accumulated actions you have taken and other people have taken.
There is an element of fate in that the past informs the future, but it does not seem like there is an element of destiny, that no matter what happens, the certain outcome is inevitable.
No, only if the accumulation of force behind you is so big that you can't stop it.
Yeah, there are some tidal waves so large you cannot outrun them.
Exactly.
Okay. It is safe to say that a Norse magical practitioner would not necessarily use fate in the same way that the rest of the mage system uses fate, as something that is preordained or predetermined. Like, it super feels to me that the Western notion of fate seems to be informed by, like, the Calvinist tradition of no matter what you do, God is going to make sure that this thing happens and that you can evade that only for so long.
Mm-hmm. Which runs, and interestingly enough, Calvinist thought specifically runs directly counter to traditional Germanic view of fate, that you could move and shift and change it and become better. Calvinist thought was about saying, no, you're stuck in this specific direction, and that runs completely counter to heathen thought.
What was the role of the magical practitioner within a Norse or Germanic culture? Was theirs a familial position or a tribal position or something everyone did maybe? Was it a role?
In some cases, and some cases, no. So generally, magic was performed by women. At least most of the source material we have is focused around women. But we also have some examples of men. Odin was a magician. There were some other magicians that we have note of. Olaf Gerstarter, elf, who is one of the kings of Norway, was noted, one, as being an elf, which is a big deal, and two, as being a magical practitioner. But because magic was tied to womanhood and femininity to some degree, it had some cultural baggage with it, because Norse culture was sadly a bit uber masculine focused, not quite as much as we see in, say, the Vikings or modern mythology around them. It was a lot more egalitarian than we view it. But concepts of masculinity and of being masculine were important and were things that we see throughout Norse culture. A lot of women tended to do magic, and there were some women that were identified specifically as Saith Kona or as Spey Wives. Most of these women were members of a community. Occasionally, they were a wise woman that was sort of on the edge or the liminal area of the community, because they were also a midwife, and so they dealt with burial and they dealt with birth, which are liminal spaces. But it depends on the era, too. A lot of magical practitioners from a Norse perspective were members of the community. At other times within history, they were very much, you know, they are slightly outside of society. So,
would there be a Norse notion of ascension, like an idea of perfecting a craft or perfecting the art or perfecting this commune with the relationships that one is a part of? And what would that look like?
This is something I've been thinking about quite a bit, actually, because I don't think there is. It runs counter to Mage's basic philosophy that there is a sense of you will get to an end, but I don't think there is an end in heathen culture. There's simply a sense of continuation. And so ascension would be more building yourself up enough to ensure that whoever succeeds you is strengthened by your actions, which is an interesting way of looking at ascension, and maybe what you're doing is passing along, because reincarnation is occasionally referenced in Norse mythology as well. Maybe you're passing along in your spirit, in your avatar, a little bit of the essence that you have built up to that next member of your family who will be reborn with it.
And when I think of Norse, I think of the Norse gods or Norse mythology, if that's a term I can use. What was that role in Norse practice? Is that something where one looks to it as signs and symbols, as a representation of the divine, as literal received history in some way? Like, what would a Norse magical practitioner's relationship to that set of cultural stories be?
In a lot of ways, story is the essential element of magic. When you're doing magic, you're helping tell a specific story. So stories that we have from Greek mythology actually tended to be referenced in the stars. They are star movements that stories were created to explain. And that may or may not have also been true in Norse culture to some degree. We have evidence that stars were really important, and that specific stars related to specific gods, and that stories were written about star movement. Insofar, now I want to spin back and talk about the fact that most magical practitioners didn't go to the gods first. They went to their local relationships, which is really important, in that they would go to their ancestors first, and then they would go to the spirits of the land around them. And then, if something was a big of enough deal, then they would go to a god and say, hey, Tyr or Frey, can you help me with this particular situation that I'm dealing with? And they would build a ritual to do so, and they would give offerings to create that sort of bond. But starting local is really important. It's not just a food movement. It's also like a heathen religious and magical practice. Like, start the smallest relationship you can and then build up from there.
But these are notionally entities that a mage could theoretically try to call upon. Were they personified, or did they have agents that one would then instead talk with? Were there avatars in the lowercase a sense? Like, would one actually speak or attempt to speak with Heimdall, or was there an agent of Heimdall or what have you? I guess, what role did the gods take in mortal happenings? Was it like the Greeks, where they were always kind of messing around with it, or did the gods mostly spend their time doing god stuff?
It's interesting, because we don't know exactly. We have the myths where it seems to indicate that the gods were interacting with the human world in Middle Earth. Middle Earth comes from Norse mythology, people, in case you didn't know that. The gods were coming from Asgard and the other seven, not nine, that's a contention, seven worlds to interact on Middle Earth. Yes, the gods existed. For most cases, we view the gods as existing within and connected to the idols that we build for them. So similar to Hindu belief where the idol or the seat of the god is really important to them existing in the place with you. That would be true of the Norse gods as well, and pillars and seats and things like that, as well as god poles, were incredibly important. But did the gods exist outside of those things as living, breathing creatures? That's a mystery that we may or may not ever have an answer to. I have interacted with the gods in my life, but what that meant to the Ark heathens or other heathens is up to them to decide.
So it is perfectly reasonable for a character in Mage who is a Norse magical practitioner to entreat one of the gods for aid. They will never reveal themselves necessarily, but they're interacting with an idol or another symbol of the god. The world around them changes, and to that mage, their prayer has been answered.
Yeah, and I think that's fine. Even I would go a step further and say it's okay in the game, in Mage, to have one of the gods directly interact with you. They can be incredibly powerful Umbrood and interact with one of their worshippers and one of the magicians or witches or whatever term you want to use that is entreating them. I am totally comfortable with that. I think as long as it's done within keeping to what the player wants and what the storyteller is comfortable doing, then rock on with your bad self. There's no issues with that.
So if a character wants to journey to the land of the gods, you made mention to there being seven realms or seven places. Is that something that we can map into the World of Darkness cosmology?
Yeah, I think so. I think fairly easily, actually. There are two realms of the dead in Norse mythology, and they sort of stack on one another, which is where like some of the numbering system gets confusing.
Oh, okay.
You can easily have that be the underworld. For example, hell simply means under the earth, where people are buried in barrows and things like that and live in their houses underneath the world. People were buried in ships and were sent somewhere in the underworld. You could easily have that fit with Stygian mythology and symbolism and wraith. You could have a Hall of the Dead in hell, in Stygia, or near, in one of the far shores, or something like that.
What do you think would be the badass name for that? Like, you have the Dark Kingdom of Iron, you have the Dark Kingdom of Sands, you have the Flaylands. Is there a Josh Heath copyrighted cool-ass name that we could use for that realm if characters wish to go there?
So, I was, for a small period of time, working with a group on Wraith the Dark Ages.
Okay.
And we were going to call it simply the Dark Kingdom of Ice.
Huh. Okay. I'll take it.
Fits, but I don't know. There's lots of different things that come to mind. It would be interesting to have it be just the Halls of the Ancestors or something like that. There's lots of different ways you could take it. So
you've talked about the underworld. You've talked about veneration of ancestors. Is it a thing where when you wanted to say something to Grandpa, Grandpa would say something back? Or was it a kind of more of a one-way thing?
Yeah, it depends. So veneration at barrows and talking to the dead is very, very common. We have tons of that within the myths to indicate there was a strict belief in the dead speaking to you. And the dead spoke in dreams to several kings. We have stories about that. We also have stories of kings sleeping on mounds. Kings are a big deal because they were the ones that were supposed to talk to other kings in their barrows. So the king would sleep on the mound. The king within the mound would speak to them in their dreams. And then we also have stories of people literally rising out of the ground as Draugr, as zombies in, you know, one context, and walking in and being like, hey, what's up? Give me a drink. I want some food. And people being like, sure, Uncle Bob, we'll happily do that for you. So the dead are very present, both also because burial practices, sometimes a barrow would be open for up to 10 years in one case, and people would go in and out and move things around and move the body into different positions and things like that. We don't know why this was done. We have lots of guesses and we have lots of like different thoughts about what could be behind it. But yeah, the dead are really important from a heathen magical context.
And I guess if you're that far north, you don't really have to worry too much about like contagion. So you can have, hey, yep, that's Uncle Jim. He made some bad choices with bears. Yep, we're all learning a lesson from that one.
Yeah, and you stack a body outside in the cold and it just freezes. And when it thaws, maybe you bury them and you go from there.
Get in there, yeah. Permafrost. So if you are a mage character with this belief, what kind of effects do you feel would involve the dead? So there would obviously be maybe magic around cultural practices to fulfill your duty to your community. But if I'm a player and I want to do something cool, what role do you feel that would take?
That's a good question. So there's lots of different things. One which sounds really weird would be there are some rotes about getting money, and entreating your ancestors for luck is the thing that you do, right?
Okay.
So it would not be odd to do an effect where you're like, hey, I'm asking my ancestors for help finding some money, and then to turn the corner and then there'd be $50 on the ground or something like that. It's a bit vulgar from a mage perspective, but I think that's totally in keeping with the type of thing that you would do. Or you might say, ancestors, give me the strength to do this next task. And suddenly it is something you are capable of doing more effectively. Like, that's the type of stuff that I would do with ancestor worship to gamify it a little bit.
Okay. So it sounds like ancestor veneration is kind of a multi-purpose focus that it could cover a bunch of things.
I think so.
Are there holy days of any sort? Are there junctures within either the reconstructed faith or what we've discovered archaeologically that a mage of a certain thing might be expected to do certain rituals on certain days or anything like that, or maybe able to draw exceptional power from a certain time of the year? Were there sacred times, and also were there sacred places that would make exceptionally good nodes or places of power or places that a character would be inclined to protect?
Interestingly enough, we haven't mentioned the verbena at all in this conversation yet, insofar as most Norse practitioners are probably going to be verbena. Only, not necessarily, because I can think of lots of different directions you could take, like someone that is a worshiper of heathenry. But the reason I mentioned the verbena have a wheel of the seasons that they follow. And that is based on, in some ways, the Wiccan calendar, which is sort of based on the Old English calendar of the year, which had 8 major holidays. Those aren't super accurate. There's only about 3 holidays we absolutely know were seen throughout the entire Norse world, including Yule, which is in the winter. We are in Yule right now. Glad Yule for those folks that are still celebrating your 12 days of Christmas. You've got Midsummer, and then you've got, like a harvest festival. So those 3 tend to be really important. And then like a 4th being like a planting festival, because they were agrarian people. So
there would be holidays. Yes. Were there any sacred sites?
Yeah. This is why I mentioned the verbena before, because sacrifice is really important from a heathen context. And in a lot of cases, the eating of meat and sacred meat was really important. So sacrificing animals and then eating the meat in a specific ritual fashion is both ancient and modernly important. So there's a place called Gamla Uppsala, which used to just be called Uppsala, which is in Sweden. And supposedly 9 of every type of creature were sacrificed every 9 years there. And at some point that would also include 9 humans who would be hung on a tree. Now, we don't know for sure if this is an accurate story because Adam of Bremen wrote it and he destroyed the tree that supposedly things were hung on. And he was kind of an asshole. So we have to assume at least to some degree that he was making it sound worse than it was. But the idea of sacrifice and the idea of ritual slaughter is incredibly important. Gulathing in Iceland, or Thingvellir. Thingvellir is where ancient thing or the assembly of people would happen in Iceland, where people would talk the law and there would be a law speaker. That was a holy place. There are lots of locations like that that you could use similar ideas for.
Was the place itself sacred, or was that the place where sacred things were done?
Yeah, there are no sacred places because sacred places are places where sacred things are done.
Things are done, okay. Mm-hmm. So would it make sense that, say my characters want to more or less create a shallowing or some other thinning of the umbra, characters could theoretically do that almost anywhere, assuming that the umbra were not like at a 7, 8, or 9 through some sort of practice. So my player could justify, instead of having a natural shallowing manifest as the umbra is always thin around me, there are certain activities that I can undertake with my community that allows me to thin the walls between worlds and allows me to enact these magics for my community or for my practice.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that can be really situational as well as established. Like, you can do regular sacrifices at a place and the gods come there and they know that they're welcome there, and so they're more present there. or you could enact different rituals at a place, and the walls of between the realms would weaken during that time frame. So yes, I absolutely agree with you. That's a thing.
Okay. So I do like the idea of the gauntlet as the wall between realms, as just one of the things in Mage I super like is when we get other terms. I think one of my favorite is the Celestial Chorus refers to the Technocracy as the Prometheans, and like refers to the Ascension War as the Endless War, like capital E, capital W, because like to them they've been fighting the Ascension War since before it was cool. Is the notion of sacrifice a payment, an act of submission? What role did the sacrifice itself take? You kind of have this Christian notion of sacrifice, which is to say, I am going to go without and lay prostrate before you, thou who I worship. And in other cases, it was, things were pretty badass. That's because of the gods. We should give them a cow. Like, sometimes it was a thank you. Sometimes it was a please. Is there a particular role that sacrifice took?
Yeah, a little bit of both, because a benediction would be different than a sacrifice of appeasement. I recently got a wonderful new job, and I pledged to Odin that I would give him a very expensive bottle of wine, and I did so, you know, in thanks for the assistance in bringing that to fruition. Is that a magical sort of effect? I think that would be odd in a mage context, but I think you can use sacrifice in this context as a method of doing a couple of different things. Doing divination, you know, haruspexy, and things like that are not unheard of within a heathen context. Using sacrifice as then a, hey, X, Y, and Z effect will occur after I let out the blood from this goat or pig usually, or I want this particular harvest to be really good, so we're going to take an egg and this white liquid that might be milk, might be something else, and I'm going to put those things into the ground and the harvest is really good. Those sorts of magical effects, like, I think you can gamify those to some degree and have them be contextually appropriate to heathenry.
So we were talking about the realms. Is there a place where the gods gathered? Was there a Mount Olympus, as it were, for the Norse pantheon?
So the gods may live in Asgard, but it depends on which gods you're talking about, because there are different groups of gods. We have a general idea of a pantheon from Snorri Sturluson, who was a writer in 1300s Iceland. He was also a chief, and he was also a bishop, and he was also a very well-read person on Greek myth, incidentally. And incidentally, he had also read the Iliad and had a major hard-on for Troy. So I mention all of this to say, like, we have this idea of a pantheon of gods, but honestly, it's probably just Snorri going, I'm going to make a pantheon to resemble the Greek gods. And the specific worship of different gods was more done in different cultic ways. And any gods that would have arrived, people probably would have worshipped, which is part of why Christianity was not pushed away, because it was just like, oh, cool, here's another god. You know, your Jesus sounds wonderful, and we're going to add him. And we have evidence of literally adding Jesus to ritual space, and just including Odin and Frey and Freya and all of the different gods in that same space. But in a Norse mythological context, we have Asgard and Vanaheim as the two homes of the gods. And I think you can bring those into Mage and say that the Aesir, or this one group of gods, lives in Asgard, and the Vanir live in Vanaheim, which probably would also be Elfheim, or the home of the elves, because the Vanir are simply giant elves in a lot of ways.
Giant in a literal sense, as in very big?
Giant as in powerful, more powerful. Okay. So there's always this sense. Everything in Norse, in a Norse or a heathen context, runs from small power to large power. That's my very bad way of describing it. So the gods exist as, hey, there's a local spirit, all the way up to one of the Aesir, who's one of the big gods. Same thing with the giants. There are giants that are, that's a troll or a mountain spirit or something like that, that is antagonistic to humanity, but not necessarily violent or out to get me, to a Thursar. And a Thursar is a giant that wants to actively kill me.
Okay. They're the more I will sharpen my teeth upon your bones kind.
Yes, exactly.
Nice, nice. What would a mage's relationship to these entities be, to the elves or to the trolls? Are they just other supernatural denizens? Would they be called on to do favors? Is there a chiminage element of there? Would you ever bribe a troll to do something for you? How is that something that we can safely bring into a game, if we can? And is there anything that we shouldn't? Are there things that we can safely bring in, and are there any we certainly shouldn't?
I don't think there's anything you necessarily shouldn't. It depends on how accurate your elves are to elves in our mythology. So the good folk, our lovely neighbors, our good neighbors, are beings you have to be very careful with in reality. You can see that I'm using language now because I'm speaking out loud in a house where they may be listening, insofar that I would want to let people know that they should be considered dangerous if you're using them in a mage context, that the good neighbors are going to potentially be problematic in that they shouldn't be like changelings necessarily. So if you are looking at creating accurate elves, they shouldn't be focused on themselves and focused on what they want and getting it. That's pretty accurate. And you may go to them and say, I have a specific deal. And it would be very similar to a devil's bargain where you would say to Satan, this is the exact parameters of our deal. Are you cool with that, Old Nick? And if Old Nick's smart, he'll try to wheel in some sort of alteration or benefit for himself into that deal. That is similar to the way one would work with the elves in a heathen context. Now, if you are talking about trolls and elves and things like that from a changeling the dreaming perspective, then run them as they are written in that game, which in some ways isn't too different than what I'm saying already, but it's going to be different than if you're saying these are spirits that I'm interacting with from a mage perspective, and then you would be careful with how you deal with trolls and elves and things like that, but you wouldn't go to them expecting them to be kind to you.
So it sounds like it is a relationship that is very transactional.
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, because a lot of things from a heathen perspective are transactional, not necessarily in a bad way, but a gift deserves a gift. And that sense of reciprocity is the central element of our worldview.
Yeah, you talked about the web of relationships. Mm-hmm. On a practical matter, if you're going somewhere and you're semi-nomadic because the harvest is bad, it is one of those things where you both need to protect what you have, but also be able to maintain the connections to the communities around you who may be doing better or may be doing worse.
Exactly.
So for instance, my mage wants something very specific, maybe a talisman or an ingredient or something. The first thing that struck me was kind of like goblin contracts in Changeling the Lost, that you could have access to this very potent force if you're willing to pay the price, but there is probably a best way to do it, and there may even be a loophole. Are the elves honorable? Like, we often represent those negative powers as being highly legalistic. They will keep their word and no more. Are the elves the same way, or are they, like, actively mischievous?
It depends on which ones you're talking about, because the answer is legalism is accurate insofar as if they're your friend. This is the thing. If someone's your friend, you don't have to be as strict about how you make a contract between a friend.
Okay.
If someone is someone you don't know well but has something you need or services you need, and you've never really interacted with one another before, but you feel confident that each other has like good intentions, but you want to make sure that everyone's on the same level, you write up a strict contract. And that, I think, is a pretty accurate representation of the types of relationships that you build there.
Is there a magical force that would enact it? Like in Changeling, the idea of contracts and oaths and vows are highly formalized and the mists enforce it, this kind of magical memory of the past. Is there any sort of analog in Norse practice, or is it just word gets around that someone didn't keep their promise?
Yes, but that's super a big deal. So okay. This goes into weird. So weird is all of your actions leading up to the things that you're doing right now. If you break an oath, then everyone around you is going to know that you broke that oath. And that's going to have major implications on your interactions with them in the future. That is true from a metaphysical standpoint as well. It's a little bit like werewolf, where werewolves earn renown because the spirits watch the different things that they do and they say, yep, that werewolf deserves that renown for doing the thing and killing the bane or whatever it is that they say that they deserve the renown for. That's the same sort of thing here, where it's like the spirits are going to tell other people, like, don't trust this dude. They broke their oath with me.
Oh, interesting. So now I am a practitioner of with a Norse paradigm, and I want to use mind magic to read someone's thoughts. In game, rather than normal telepathy, what I may actually be doing is talking to those spirits and saying, this person is untrustworthy. This is reflected in their weird for all the promises they've broken or what have you. Mm-hmm. So we now get a reskinning on that allows us to use the mind sphere, but also apply this worldview in a reasonable and integrated way.
The other thing you could do with the mind sphere is if you focus on like dreams and daydream, even where you take out like maybe you utilize a set of runes where you focus on different runes where you're trying to understand how a person's thinking, and then you would get like a daydream of their thoughts. So dream and daydream and things like that are really important as well.
You just mentioned the runes. We've talked about the elves as entities that you could possibly entreat with. We've talked about that there are two places one could go if one wanted to have a court of a Norse court in the High Umbra. You could talk to the Aesir or the Vanir, depending on what you wanted to do. Did they generally have a dominion? Like, did the Vanir cover one thing and the Aesir kind of cover another thing, or...
Yeah, it's a good question. The answer is no, because again, we have Snorri's false pantheon that was created, and he said, oh, Thor is a god of war, and he is a god of lightning, and he's not god of the hammer. That was a Marvel reference. Anyway, in that context, yes, he created like domains or spheres of influence, but honestly, you know, Tyr was a fertility god. Woden was a fertility god at one point. Thor was a fertility god. Frigga, they were all at one point fertility gods and goddesses. So, yeah, you know, when you have a culture that's like, we're barely surviving, you're like, whichever god is like, will listen, I'm going to go and talk to. So they have a lot of overlap.
That kind of reminds me of a lot of the Greek mystery cults, mm-hmm. where you'd be like, yeah, we're going to talk to Hephaestus, god of wisdom, or something like that. That's not the stereotype I associate with. It's your god. When you're the god of a hammer, everything looks like a nail. I don't know where I was going with that. But okay.
No, you're right. That's actually a good point. Like, sometimes you have these what we call hati, or like extra names or ideas or like paradigmatic reflections of. And so a god like Thor might be called like Thor Woden when he has an element similar to Odin's type of spheres of influence. You might call him that as a way of referencing a specific story or idea or like thought.
So it would make sense to invoke an aspect, or I am going to reflect or cast runes upon this story that I know that manifests this particular power or outcome or idea that I want my magic to be informed by.
Yeah, I think that sounds accurate.
You said the R word, runes. And you mentioned that they're just a writing system, which makes sense in the same way that it would be like someone thousands of years from now, someone unearthing the Vatican or something like that and being like, oh, we know this was a sacred site and this is their sacred script. And then someone later finding a phone book or a dictionary and going like, this is the same script. This must be a holy book.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just an alphabet. When did all these other kind of mystical associations pop up?
Okay, so it's just an alphabet for a society that believes that reputation and memory are the most important things you can have. So remembering someone and the things that they did means they are still alive, means that they're still present, means that they still have a way to impact the world. So yes, they are just a writing system, but that doesn't mean they're not magical.
In the same way that as if I were to be an actuariomancer, if someone were to say they're just numbers, I would throw a shit fit.
Exactly.
Okay.
That said, in the first Norse Renaissance or revival in the 1600s, actually that's the second Norse Renaissance, but anyway, there was a focus on the runes because there was this idea that they were secrets, because rune means secret. Any idea or thought that you store is a secret until you know how to read it. They were used as a tool to create amulets in the heathen era. We know this. We see runes all over things, usually in nonsense words, as an incantation perhaps, or something like that. We don't know for sure what they were intended to do. We have Alu runes, and that's a set of three runes that spell out Alu. We have no idea what that means, except for maybe it was like an incantation that was used to cause a specific effect. We have all of that. And then in the 1800s, in the third romanticized period of Norse stuff, where you have Grimm and you have some of the early Germanic rune peoples. These were people that were taking runes and saying, yeah, they have all these magical powers and talking about different things with them. They created entire systems of divination around runes and all of these magical systems that we see today. So I would, from a mage perspective, use those more in the Order of Hermes, where the hermetics are like, hey, I'm going to go out and I'm going to follow like this 1800s era runic system, and it's in keeping with a more hermetic mindset. I think that would be accurate. Or maybe you'd have a hollow one that was like, hey, this is very Victorian, because that was the like fourth romanticism of the Norse era. Then they would say, okay, I'm going to use these runes because that was a thing that was done in the Noriona society and some other groups at that time, or the Thule society. There's also some bad connections to runes in this era. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, it's one of those things where sometimes I encounter certain, I'm not even sure what to call it, but interpretations where it kind of strikes me as, I don't know if you've heard the joke, waterboarding at Guantanamo Bay sounds like a lot of fun if you know what none of those words mean.
Yeah.
What are the ways in which these faiths or practices have been either weaponized or misrepresented? And what are the tropes that we need to avoid if we want to bring this into our game?
Let me start back in the 1600s. Some of the Norse romanticism that happened was about nationalism.
Okay.
And a lot of, some heathens will get upset about this, but a lot of modern heathenry can be directly traced back to one or another of these nationalized movements and to these racialized movements. And for those heathens like myself who want nothing to do that, who reject it, who do everything we can to say this has nothing to do with actual heathen practice, the best thing we can do is acknowledge the roots of modern heathenry in those movements. And as shitty as they are, because they were focused on creating a nationalized identity and focused on colonialism and being shitty to people within their society. So Nazis, neo-Nazis, and things like that use runes a lot. The Nazis use runes because they identified them as core elements of Germanic culture. And yes, in some cases they were, and then they bastardized them. They took the Filflot, what we call the swastika, and they made that a symbol of hate and destruction, and it will never be saved. No matter what you say, if you are a heathen and you're using a swastika, I'm sorry, you're probably doing it wrong, because there's almost no way to save that symbol from the corruption that it is facing at this stage. If you want to have villains be Nazi villains and use runes and things like that, be members of the Thule Society or be members of von Liszt's, or Guido von Liszt was a rune mage who created a whole system of runic yoga as well. You can, it's weird. Yeah, you can do that. I'm okay. I encourage you to make your villains like that, but also know that there are heathens out there that reject all of that. And it would be more interesting to have your Nazi villains be fighting against heathens who are like, we want nothing to do with you, because that's much more accurate to how we deal with things in our modern communities.
And even within mage history, there was that division during World War II, at least in canon, that it was one of those things where it's like, who's going to cooperate with the technocracy? And it turned out some of the Verbena did, because these ideas of preserving culture and purity and so on, a lot of some pretty misguided mages kind of behind that. Are there any certain terms or phrases that are a good guideline when someone is doing investigation that says, maybe this is a source I should or shouldn't trust?
Yeah, if you read anything that says anything about being folkish, F-O-L-K-ish, I-S-H, you should avoid that source from there on. It is a bastardization of the German Völkisch, which is specifically a neo-Nazi reference to the folk, and things like blood and soil. Those are also really big red flags. Usually you'll see those, and those will be pretty clear. If you see any of the runes with kicked up legs, or like the bottom halves are twisted or shifted at all, either inward or outward, that is a bad sign. That is probably a white supremacist symbol in one form or another. True of any of the runes. You specifically see it with the Othala rune, but any of them, if they have their legs moved in one way or another, that's a bad sign. So those are the things that come to mind, is like, these are immediate red flags to me.
It's a good first pass sniff test, at least. Are there sources that you feel players could go to for good information if they would like to inform their game or learn more about the practice?
Yeah. Well, my wife has a website called seahelruna.com. That's SEOHELRUNE.com. And she talks about her various uses of magic and her interpretations of Norse magical practices, as well as some other things. She's a really clever writer. So I really recommend her website. She's also got a book, which is a kind of a collection of essays that she wrote that you can find on her website that I recommend. And she's about to release another book, hopefully at the end of this year, which will be published by Llewellyn. That said, in your question is like, what's out there right now? That's a good resource. There's not a lot of good stuff. Okay. That is out there. So there's some books that I would recommend. There's a book called Taking Down the Runes, which by Diana Paxson, which has some problems, but is overall a good book about the runes. And otherwise, from a Norse magic standpoint, there's not another book out there that I would recommend.
Okay. So how are the runes used in magical practice?
They are inscribed, written down, and or cut into an object to cause an effect. Now, you can either write the runes as a word. You can write the runes as a bind rune, where you take several different runes and you say, this is an effect I want, and these different runes altogether would cause that sort of effect. Then you would write them as one sigil. Those are two ways that come to mind. You might weave them into an object. You might, for example, when I was deployed, I put runes in the middle of the heat shields on my M16. If I needed to shoot it, the idea was they would shoot straight and true. Thankfully, I never needed to, so that was a good thing. Or you might use runes as a protective thing, where you would write them on a piece of paper and put it in your pocket and say, you know, this is a shield in my pocket.
Okay, so a Norse magician wants to use something analogous to the Hermetic Parma Magica, a quintessence reserve. Is there a object or a class of sacred objects that you think would be good vessels for that? Like when you said carve it and put it in your pocket, it super reminded me of the Prime 2 effect Parma Magica. What would be a Norse analog to that, if there is one?
Oh, there are two that come to mind. The staff would be one thing. Staves were really important, partially because women used them to put wool on and used them as a spinning tool. But also that would be could be a very good holder of quintessence or something like that. A horn, a drinking horn would be a good one, because the idea of the drinking horn being a vessel that's really important for magical purposes. Those are the two that come to mind. I like the idea of maybe having the runes or a rune bag also be a quintessence thing, because the Garu have something similar to that, where they have a bag full of gnosis. They're little gnosis bites, almost
chock full of wisdom. I never got the embodied idea of gnosis quite so much as the embodied idea of quintessence, but yeah. So the Norse people and the Vikings and so on kind of pop up in every World of Darkness line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because people like Vikings.
We have the trolls, we have the Gangrel. Are there any that you think are particularly well done, or is there any class of night folk from the commonly played ones that you think are particularly rife for maybe a Norse magic practitioner to have crossover with?
Mm-hmm. I think they're all problematic in certain ways, but I also love them in other ways. So the Gangrel as the classic Viking is a little ridiculous, but okay. I also like it. Like, it's one of those places where it's fine. Have this guy be called Wolf, and you're oh, yes, I clearly know that you are a Gangrel from, Denmark in 877, sir. Clearly. That's fine. You can do that. Or Varg, which is just another word for wolf. You can do that. And, that's fine. It's just kind of a trite sort of a stereotype. That said, though, Wolves of the Sea, which is a Dark Ages book about vampires in Scandinavia, is actually really good, and in some ways gets heathen culture and Norse culture more accurate than some books on those topics have.
Wait, did you just compliment a World of Darkness book?
I did. It's probably the first time you've ever heard that.
I think it's the second, Henge Yokai. this brings the total number of Josh Heath-approved books, I think, to two.
I said good things about Rage Across New York and Rage Across Russia.
I hadn't started listening to your show yet, I guess.
But yeah, Wolves of the Sea is actually a pretty decent book. So one that I would recommend to people that want any context on ancient heathen culture.
How about the trolls of Changeling?
I am not a super big expert on Changeling. I've only read a little bit. I've read three books of Changeling.
Okay.
That said, I like the trolls as nothing like what trolls are in mythology at all. I like that the trolls are a reflection of honor and of responsibility and all of that. I think that's super appropriate for a crossover for mage and changeling. It's just not really accurate for trolls at all, and that's fine.
Okay. And is there a notion of the dead? Would a Viking wraith or specter or ghost look like?
Oh, yeah. I think, well, we've talked about this before, where ancestors are super important. I would have wraiths be an essential element of any character like this. They should be treating with the dead regularly, if you ask me. And so having them have, like, the race of their ancestors that are Christians and don't like the fact that they're, like, worshiping the Norse gods, that's a super clever trope to lean into. I don't know if that's a trope just from, like, a heathen context, but... Mm-hmm. Super like interesting thing to dig into, as well as saying like, hey, here's an ancient crew of Vikings that are, they still have their relic ship and are still like sailing through the waters, the tempest outside Stygia, and maybe they're raiding Stygia on a regular basis. I think that would be a super cool story. Yeah.
Oh, that's badass. Telling tales and collecting pathos and, mm-hmm. and so on, stealing soul seal and such.
And I mentioned a group of them in my book on the Storyteller's Vault for Wraith. The one that I did for the Great War actually has a reference to, like, hey, there are Vikings amongst this group of people.
Oh, interesting. What book is that?
Renegades of Mercury, Love's Messengers. That's the name of the book.
And I guess my final question is, I am on a one-person mission to avoid the trope of saying, so a dream speaker walks into a bar and having that mean much of anything. To me, a tradition is a rough paradigm plus a political unit.
Mm-hmm.
So I like the idea of practice and culture not necessarily being a direct line to a tradition. They can be correlated, but they aren't necessarily a straight line. So what are some weird cases where a Norse magical practitioner would pop up in the other traditions that we may not first think of? Like, for instance, is there a meditative, contemplative, or anchorite or hermit practice where we could suddenly see a Norse Akashic? Because communing with the Akasha and talking with your ancestors sounds super similar to me in certain critical ways.
Yeah, I think you could honestly have a heathen in every tradition or convention that is out there in one way or another. Having the Akashana that is also a heathen Saith Kona or Saith Manar, I think that would be super cool. Like, they're a person that maybe they do some traditional practices from Tibet or something like that as well. They could potentially be initiated into both traditions. I think that's totally appropriate because they are not in conflict with one another, because okay. In some ways they're both about saying, hey, communing with your ancestors and interacting with them and pleasing them is a good thing. And you can do it in these two different ways. So absolutely appropriate there. I think the classic ones obviously are Verbena and Order of Hermes. Those are the ones that people, I think, would automatically go to, with the Verbena being the obvious because of the sacrifice elements and the blood elements and things like that, and the old ways elements. Fine to go in those directions. I think my favorite, though, too, would be Virtual Adepts and the Void Engineers. The Virtual Adepts, there's a lot of internet heathens, and there's a lot of us that found each other through the internet. My very first tour on the World Wide Web was to search for Ausatru websites, and I found them in 1996.
That is a word that I have heard before, mostly mispronounced. What is that, the A word you used?
So it is a neologism to refer to faith in the Aesir. So there's lots of different pronunciations between Norway, Denmark, Sweden, and Iceland. In Iceland, they say Ausatru. I don't use it as often any longer because some of the groups in the U.S. that use it are racist asshats, but it's spelled Asatru.
To kind of continue our tour of the traditions, I love the idea of someone as the captain of the SS Bifrost. Are there any odd views of nature or theories of the world that you think a Society of Aether practitioner would glom onto? Like, could it just be a case of, hey, we have all these stories about people coming up with weird potions and such. I don't think that's magical. I just think they had this form of alchemy that we don't fully understand now. And darn it, I'm going to figure it out.
Yeah, the Norse people were super scientific as people were in that era.
Yeah.
They had crystals that they utilized to help them navigate in bad weather.
Yeah, the Sunstone.
And the idea of the Sunstone, like, we knew it existed. We didn't find them until somewhat relatively recently. We were like, oh, yeah, we knew this was a concept. Now we have one. So that idea, I think, is definitely Aetherite ready. The idea of medical magical practices is super keen. And some of that stuff is legit, where we know now, like, a specific type of plant that you set a specific like charm over. Well, the thing is the chemicals in the plant move from one place to the other when you're doing the chant in exactly that length of time that it takes. And if you don't wait that exact amount of time, you're going to poison yourself. But if you do it with the charm, you time it perfectly right. There are things like that that I think are totally like having like a mad like doctor as an etherite and a heathen, I think would be super cool.
Oh man, so Dr. Futhark is going to be in your next supplement?
Maybe, maybe not.
Okay. Are there heathen ecstatic practices if I want to have a Norse cultist? Or is there an idea of another place or another realm of consciousness that one would attempt to access?
Yeah, I think you could do that with psychoactive drugs. So we have at least one burial where the Saith woman was found with marijuana, or I should say cannabis seeds. Mm-hmm. So we know that that was a thing, as well as going under the cloak, which is a ritual practice of communing with the elves by putting a cloak over you and getting wisdom from them. I think that's an ecstatic practice if you do it the right way. Drumming, singing, dancing, these are things that the Norse did. Galdr is a type of singing specific noises to have specific effects. You could use that from an ecstatic perspective. So I think that definitely fits.
And I feel like Dream Speaker is also obvious in that you have an idea of a world that is animistic or semi-animistic that you're constantly communing with and you're contacting the spirits of the world around you to see what the current state of debt is. Is there another angle on that that we should consider or keep in mind, or is that, or do you think we've kind of covered that guy?
I think that fits. I think my struggle with that is because the Dream Speakers are focused on indigenous cultures, that I would say that the heathen in that perspective would probably also be really interested in Sama practices and then say, like, yeah, I worship Thor and Odin, but also I give honor and worship to the Sama gods who I sadly... pronunciation of one of their names that I would Menakainen. I would say they would also offer worship to those gods as well, and I think that would be appropriate.
Is there a notion of nemesis or of like the Erinyes, like an agent of the gods that do justice? Like if I wanted to have a Thanatoic practitioner, like there's the one angle of tracking the avatars. And as you had mentioned earlier, the idea of my goal now is to create a better world for the community that comes after me. And to me, that meshes really easy with the tenders of the wheel or any of the societies that kind of track the movement of avatars. But is there a notion of my role is to deliver some sort of justice? Could someone be an agent of the weird, that my job here is to see that you pay for what you have and you have outrun it and I am preventing you from running further? Does that hit that misinterpretation that we're worried about?
That's definitely hitting the misinterpretation, but I like it in a different direction. So Tyr is a god of justice and god of the thing, and we have some other small gods underneath him that also were about justice and law and things like that. So you could easily say that Euthanatos is like, Tyr is my patron, for lack of a better term, and I am following through on the justice element that he would bring to my people. So I think you could go in that angle.
So the Celestial Chorus is notionally monotheistic, but often there are some broad interpretations of that. Is there an idea that a practitioner could say to be like, yes, I recognize the gods, but in reality, they are all just servants of this thing, or that there is a divine creation force or a void that they came out of? And these are, to me, just aspects of that thing, or is that just missing the point?
Yeah, the problem is that from a heathen perspective, the gods are individualized beings and not emanations of a greater force. But if you wanted to have someone that was on the edge of being a heathen, you could do one of two things. You could say they're a universalist that believes the gods are simply connected to a greater divinity and they represent as avatars of that divinity in a fractured space. I think that would be all right. The other thing you could potentially do is say they're a henotheist who worships Odin as god. Or they say, hey, I have all of these practices about Galdr, which are the god spell. For example, this is a different angle to take it in. You could have a Christian that was converted during the Gothic conversion when we have a copy of the Bible translated into Gothic, which talks about Jesus having hill forts and his warrior thanes, his 12 warrior thanes, who were his disciples, and talks about like him being a warrior on the cross and things like this. You could have a heathen-inspired Christian who's coming at it from that angle, and I think you'd be sort of in a similar space.
Which is interesting because to not look at Christianity in general, but specifically the Catholic Church is dealing with conversion of indigenous and Aboriginal peoples at current. And if you go to certain areas of Amazonia, and this is within the remit of the Catholic Church, the nativity scene is the wise men bringing acai berries on a canoe.
Yep.
So for anyone who thinks that that Catholicism is above syncretization or localization, think again. Now, mind you, not everyone agrees on that, but the idea Josh is bringing up is not at all far-fetched, I guess, is the key thing to me. So we have done a whirlwind tour. We have covered all the traditions. We've covered all the focuses. There is Dead Magic 2, which you said you didn't necessarily have an opinion on, but it was revised, so it's probably 70% right.
Yeah, probably 50%, but you know.
I'm giving the benefit of the doubt. Are there any other thoughts that you would like our audience to have to keep in mind as they maybe try and weave this into their chronicle?
Yeah. The other thing that I would say is that you can have your convention members also be heathens. Don't forget the technocracy. All of them also lean into this in one form or another. That, and don't be afraid to get it wrong, and no one's going to be offended at you if you depict Norse magic in a way that's a little bit stereotypical. I might roll my eyes and laugh, but I'm not going to be mad, because we know that from a cultural standpoint that Thor is a comic book character, and that the Vikings is a popular TV show, and that Norse magical and cultural practices are depicted in ways that are kind of silly and ridiculous in popular media. And we're not usually mad about that. Usually we love those sources of media as well. We just know, like, that's the non-sacred version of our stories. This is a sacred version of our stories. We're comfortable with both those things existing.
Nice. And if I want to throw a Nephondic thing into there, could I have the servants of, like, Jormungand or something like that? Or...
So if you want to have Nephondic Norse practitioners, here's the angle that I would take it in. You want to have them be what are called Rokkertru. So this is a terrible word. It means nothing. But there is a word, Ragnarok. Ragnarok means the twilight of the gods. Well, some modern practitioners have leaned into this idea of the twilight and serving the twilight and serving the Rokker, who are creatures like Jormungand and Angerboda, who's the mother of Jormungandr, and Fenris, and all of these monstrous creatures that want to destroy the gods and destroy humanity. That's totally a Nephondic thing. You could easily do that, and I think it would be totally appropriate.
Oh, awesome. And with that, if people are interested in other things you've written or what you have to say, where can we find out more, Josh?
Well, you can always listen to Werewolf the Podcast, where I pontificate about Werewolf the Apocalypse. You can also find about 1,000 books of mine on the Storyteller's Vault by looking up Josh Heath or Joshua Heath. You can find me in highlevelgames.ca, where I am the COO. You can also find me on openhalls.org if you're interested in the Open Halls Project. And otherwise, don't find me. But if you want to find me, you can find me in all those places.
Josh is also on the Mage the Podcast Discord server, discord.me/MageThePodcast. Josh also participates in the Mage the Ascension Facebook group, probably the Werewolf Facebook group. That's like the one I haven't done yet. And one day Josh is going to storytell Werewolf for me. I have 1/3 of a concept for an idea of something that could be a character. So I'm getting there. But the important part is I read the core rule book. And if you're interested in supporting Mage the Podcast, please go to magethepodcast.com, find out how to become an executive producer, get your name in the credits, help us guide the show into 2020, send us an email, magethepodcast@gmail.com, follow us on Twitter @MageThePodcast. If this is your first episode or you haven't subscribed yet, please subscribe to us on iTunes through Stitcher or through Spotify, or listen directly through anchor.fm or through magethepodcast.com. And with that, Terry out.
Bye.